and laughed at this sexist, racist double whammy, and hugged me with sympathy as if I had been the wronged one. And in a way, they were partly right. White people should have sued for being culturally deprived in a white ghetto. When humans are ranked instead of linked, everyone loses. These young women were not looking to Washington, as Malcolm X might have feared, nor were they waiting to be asked to speak. They were complete unto themselves, as in the line from one of Alice Walker's poems in Revolutionary Petunias, blooming gloriously for itself. Malcolm X would have been proud of them, too. I knew the oldest of his six daughters, Atala Shabazz, an elegant and experienced version of those self-possessed young women. She was a writer, speaker, activist, and by then a grandmother herself. Getting to know her had been a gift of the road. When we talked again, she told me something I'd never heard or read. Malcolm X had been in Washington for that historic 1963 march. He stayed in the hotel suite of actor and activist Ossie Davis, who spoke at the march and made sure Dr. King knew he was there in support. But as his daughter explained, he also knew his presence would have disrupted or split the focus, and he was a supporter of the big picture. Somehow I found this little-known fact very moving. These two men seemed to be growing toward each other. Dr. King was becoming more radical by speaking out on issues like the Vietnam War, and Malcolm X was beginning to talk about a bloodless revolution. Some tragedies become more tragic. They might have become part of the same talking circle. Thanks to Mrs. Green and many others brave enough to stand up for themselves and other women, I began to understand that females were an out-group, too. That realization solved such mysteries as why the face of Congress was male but the face of welfare was female. Why homemakers were called women who don't work, though they worked longer, harder, and for less pay than any other class of worker. Why women did 70% of the productive labor in the world, paid and unpaid, yet owned only 1% of the property. Why masculinity meant leading and femininity meant following in the odd dance of daily life. More than ever, I found myself wanting to report on this new view of the world as if everyone mattered. But it was still the 1960s, and even my most open-minded editor explained that if he published an article saying women were equal, he would have to publish one next to it saying women were not, in order to be objective. I had retreated into writing profiles of Margot Fonteyn, the dancer I couldn't be, or Dorothy Parker, Saul Bellow, and other authors I admired, which seemed as close as I would ever get to being an author myself. Then two women from a lecture bureau wrote to ask if I would speak to groups who had expressed curiosity about this new thing called women's liberation. I'd recently written a piece for my column in New York Magazine, After Black Power, Women's Liberation. It had been triggered by my own click of consciousness, namely that I had been silent and silenced about an abortion I'd had years before. Like many women, I'd been made to feel at fault, not realizing there were political reasons why female humans were not supposed to make decisions about our own bodies. I was intrigued by the offer, but I had a big problem. I was terrified of public speaking. I'd so often canceled at the last minute when magazines booked me on television to publicize this or that article, as writers were often expected to do, that some shows had blacklisted me. Fortunately, I had a friend named Dorothy Pittman Hughes, a pioneer of non-sexist, multiracial childcare in New York, a fearless speaker, a mother, and a member of an extended black family in rural Georgia, all things I was not. We had met when I wrote about her community childcare center for New York Magazine. As we sat on child-sized chairs, sharing lunch on paper plates, her one assistant, a young Italian radical, told us he was sad. The girl he loved wouldn't marry him because he wouldn't allow her to work after marriage. Dorothy and I didn't know each other, but we went to work pointing out parallels between equality for women and the rest of his radical politics. It actually worked. Since we had been successful one-on-one, Dorothy suggested we speak to audiences as a team. Then we could each talk about our different but parallel experiences, and she could take over if I froze or flagged. Right away, we discovered that a white woman and a black woman speaking together attracted far more diverse audiences than either one of us would have done on our own. I also found that if I confessed my fear of public speaking, audiences were not only tolerant but sympathetic. Public opinion polls showed that many people fear public speaking even more than death. I had company. We started in school basements with a few people on folding chairs and progressed to community centers, union halls, suburban theaters, welfare rights groups, high school gyms, YWCAs, and even a football stadium or two. Soon we discovered the intensity of interest in the simple idea that each person's shared humanity and individual uniqueness far outweighed any label by group of birth, whether sex, race, class, sexuality, ethnicity, religious heritage, or anything else. That's why my first decade or so on the road wasn't spent going to meetings of the business and professional women, or the American Association of University Women, or even the National Organization for Women. I was traveling to campuses, meetings of the National Welfare Rights Organization, the United Farm Workers, 9 to 5, which was a new group of and for clerical workers. Lesbian groups, sometimes excluded both by mainstream feminists and by gay men, and the political campaigns of anti-Vietnam War and new feminist candidates. We came to see our job as creating a context in which audiences themselves could become one big talking circle and discover they were neither crazy nor alone in their experiences of unfairness or efforts to be both their unique selves and to find a community. As in India all those years earlier, they told their own stories. Often these talking circles went on twice as long as our talks. When we first started speaking at the very end of the 1960s, the war in Vietnam was the main cause of activism. Buildings were being occupied and draft cards burned. At the same time, the gay and lesbian movement was moving out of the underground and into a public arena, and the Native American movement was trying to stop the purposeful obliterating of their languages, culture, and history. As always, the idea of freedom was contagious. A few years earlier, in the 1960s, women a decade or so older than I had begun to reject the feminine mystique of the suburbs, as brilliantly and lethally described by Betty Friedan in her bestseller, and to demand women's rightful place in the paid workforce. Friedan had dared to name this glorified consumer role that women's magazines were forcing on readers, though to be fair, advertisers were forcing it on editors, but younger and more radical women didn't want just a job and a piece of the existing pie. They wanted to bake a new pie altogether. Eventually, these more conservative women came to agree that feminism had to include all women. Lesbians, women on welfare, the intertwining of sex and race for women of color, everyone. And the more radical women of diverse races and classes no longer turned up their noses at the idea of making change from inside the system as well as outside. Though the starting places of these various activist groups have been very different and had created pain and misunderstanding, by the end of the 1970s they came together as fractious, idealistic, diverse, and effective parts of the same movement. Given my age of just over 30, I was in between these two groups of women, one trying to integrate and the other to transform. But because of my experience, I was drawn to the more radical and younger ones. I wasn't married and living in the suburbs. I'd always been in the workforce, but the gender ghetto in journalism was not just a glass ceiling. It was a glass box. Also, India had taught me that change grows from the bottom like a tree, and that caste or race can double or triple women's oppression. Soon, feminism became a brush fire that spread coast to coast. and some people viewed it with the same alarm. To the religious right wing and much of the mainstream, we were defying God, family, and the patriarchy they decreed. To the left wing and some in the mainstream, bringing up bias against females was a distraction from struggles over class, race, and other issues that were taken more seriously because they also affected men. Nonetheless, the idea of equality was so contagious that the right wing would soon rate feminism as a danger right up there with secular humanism and godless communism. The American mainstream began to support issues of equality in public opinion polls, even when some of those issues were still thought of simply as life. Think of sexual harassment or domestic violence. After Dorothy had a baby and decided to travel less, my partners became friends and colleagues like Margaret Sloan, a black feminist poet and activist from Chicago's South Side, and Florence Kennedy, a civil rights lawyer and an infinitely quotable and charismatic speaker. Flo especially took me in hand. When I felt I had to prove the existence of discrimination with statistics, for instance, she pulled me aside. "If you're lying in the ditch with a truck on your ankle," she said patiently, "you don't send somebody to the library to find out how much the truck weighs. You get it off." I always spoke first. Especially after Flo, I would have been an anticlimax. And we each talked about our own experience of seeing talent wasted by imaginary limits of race, gender, class, sexuality, and so on, including the prison of masculinity that limits men. To make a balance between speakers and audience, we did our best to split the time equally between our talk and an audience free-for-all. I knew this was working when, say, someone on one side of the hall asked a question and someone on the other side answered it. People stood up and spoke about ideas and experiences they might never have brought up, even with a friend. Together and separately, we as speakers disproved another description used to disqualify feminists, that we were all white middle class, a phrase used by the media then, and academics who believe those media clippings now, as if it were a single adjective to describe the women's movement. In fact, the first ever nationwide poll of women's opinions on issues of gender equality showed that African American women were twice as likely as white women to support them. If the poll had included Latinas, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and other women of color, the result might well have been even more dramatic. After all, if you've experienced discrimination in one form, you're more likely to recognize it in another. Also, racism and sexism are intertwined, as Mrs. Green and millions of others experienced, and cannot be uprooted separately. Traveling in an interracial team taught me some important and unsettling truths about this country. Though we were both speaking about women's liberation, for instance, reporters would ask me questions about women and then ask Dorothy or Flo or Margaret about civil rights. This was true even though Flo was 18 years older than I and had been very public as a feminist lawyer. We learned to let this effort to divide us go for a while before naming it, whether with anger and humor, as in Flo's case, or with history, as in the case of Margaret, who recited Sojourner Truth's "But Ain't I a Woman?" This was a small taste of a general problem. The invisibility in the media of the many women of color who pioneered the women's movement. In the way that image can overwhelm reality, nothing but struggle for decades would keep this from becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. Sometimes sexual politics took petty and odd forms. For example, I had been called a pretty girl before I was identified as a feminist in my mid-30s. Then suddenly I found myself being called beautiful. Not only was I described by my appearance more than ever before, but I was told that how I looked was the only reason I got any attention at all. In 1971, the St. Petersburg Times headlined, "Gloria's beauty belies her purpose." It took me a few years to figure out this sudden change in response to the same person. I was being measured against the expectation that any feminist had to be unattractive in a conventional sense, and then described in contrast to that stereotype. The subtext was, if you could get a man, why would you need equal pay? This grew into an accusation that I was listened to only because of how I looked, and a corollary that the media had created me. Though I'd been a freelance writer all my professional life, without being told that my appearance was the reason I got published, it now became the explanation for everything, no matter how hard I worked. Never mind that the opposite was sometimes the case, as when my literary agent had sent me to an editor at a major national magazine who dismissed me by saying, "We don't want a pretty girl, we want a writer." The idea that whatever I had accomplished was all about looks would remain a biased and hurtful accusation even into my old age. Fortunately, traveling and speaking took me to audiences full of down-home common sense. When a reporter raised the question of my looks as more important than anything I could possibly have to say, for example, an older woman rose in the audience. "Don't worry, honey," she said to me comfortingly. "It's important for someone who could play the game and win to say, the game isn't worth shit." I also learned from my speaking partners. When we were in the South especially, some man in the audience might assume that a black woman and a white woman traveling together must be lesbians. Florence Kennedy modeled the perfect response. "Are you my alternative?" If someone called me a lesbian, in those days all single feminists were assumed to be lesbians, I learned just to say, "Thank you." It disclosed nothing, confused the accuser, conveyed solidarity with women who were lesbians, and made the audience laugh. I also came to appreciate this two-way understanding that happens only when we're all in the same space. It gradually made me less reluctant to go out on my own. Nervousness might still return, like malaria, but mostly I'd learned that audiences turn into partners if you just listen to them as much as you talk. After I joined with a group of writers and editors to start Ms. Magazine, I was traveling not only for stories, but also to sell ads to reluctant makers of cars who were convinced that men made that buying decision, to explain to makers of women's products why Ms. didn't publish fashion, beauty, or cooking articles that praised and promoted the products of advertisers, and to persuade newsstand dealers to carry a new kind of women's magazine whose cover looked nothing like the others. I remember going from city to city buying donuts and coffee for men who loaded boxes of magazines onto the trucks at dawn, hoping they would persuade newsstand dealers to at least open our boxes. Soon, I was also traveling state by state to campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment, or for new women candidates who represented women's majority needs and views, or for male candidates who were doing this too, or to fundraise for various parts of this movement that I cared about so much. In the 1980s, I published my first real book, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, and discovered the author's tour as a new kind of road trip. There were actually author's escorts, often freelancers themselves, who knew each city and schlepped authors around to book signings and media appearances. That, plus two more books and tours in the 1990s, made me realize that bookstores were the great community centers. Anybody could come, whether they could afford a book or not, and the spaces reserved for talks and signings invited talking circles. Since no computer can provide this companionship, the more personal the store, the more likely it is to survive. I know that some authors hate book tours, and maybe I would too if I had to keep repeating the plot of one novel, but I grew to love these spontaneous gatherings in shopping malls, university bookstores, and specialty bookshops that couldn't be replaced by the big chains, all the spaces with coffee, comfortable chairs, and the presence of books that allow people to browse and discover interests they didn't know they had. Recently, when a book of mine was published in India, I did a tour of bookstores from Jaipur and New Delhi to Kolkata. Those, too, range from big cheerful chains to small discussion-filled, art-filled shops. Altogether, if I had to pick one place to hang out anywhere from New York to Cape Town and Australia to Hong Kong, a bookstore would be it. Every author also creates a world of her or his own. I watched Bette Midler sign every last book for her hundreds of fans lined up around the block, all while wearing a perky hat made to look like a piano. Oliver North of the Iran-Contra arms scandal had two guards carrying poorly concealed guns, took no questions, and signed copies of Under Fire, An American Story, the explosive autobiography of Oliver North. Ai-Jen Poo, who won a MacArthur Genius Award for her organizing of domestic workers, turned book signings into rallies. No one left one of her events without knowing that living longer is not a crisis, it's a blessing, that the 12 million Americans over 85 will double in number by 2035, and that many home care workers will be needed, and that these workers deserve the same legal rights as workers anywhere else. Altogether, I can't imagine technology replacing bookstores completely, any more than movies about a country replace going there. Wherever I go, bookstores are still the closest thing to a town square. There are events that divide our lives into before and after. I notice that most people, when asked to name such an event, cite something that gave them a feeling of emotional connection, whether it was witnessing a birth, or walking New York streets after 9/11, or viewing a photo of our fragile planet from space. Mine was an event you may never have heard of, the 1977 National Women's Conference in Houston. It may take the prize as the most important event nobody knows about. In 3 days, plus the 2 years leading up to them, my life was changed by a new sense of connection with issues, possibilities, and women I came to know in the trenches. The conference also brought a huge and diverse movement together around shared issues and values. You might say it was the ultimate talking circle. I'm not alone in being a different person after Houston. In the years since then, I've met diverse women who were there, and everyone has told me of some way in which she too was transformed. Her hopes and ideas of what was possible for the world, for women in general, and for herself. Because 18,000 observers came to Houston from 56 other countries, and because delegates were chosen to represent the makeup of each state and territory, it was probably the most geographically, racially, and economically representative body this nation has ever seen, much more so than Congress, not even close. Issues to be voted on in Houston also had been selected in every state and territory. It was a constitutional convention for the female half of the country. After all, we had been excluded from the first one. If you wonder why you haven't heard about this event, I'm glad. It all began in 1972 when the United Nations declared that 1975 would be International Women's Year, right up there with the Year of the Child or the Year of the Family Farm. In 1974, President Gerald Ford appointed a 39-member delegation to represent U.S. women and named a man from the State Department to head it. But the one who took on this task of finding out what issues and hopes really did represent the female half of this country was Congresswoman Bella Abzug, a woman who never thought small. She enlisted Congresswoman Patsy Mink as co-author and Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm as co-conspirator in writing a revolutionary piece of legislation. It called for federal funding for 56 open, economically, and racially representative conferences over 2 years, one in every state and territory. Delegates elected and issues selected at each meeting would then go to a national conference in Houston. There, a national plan of action would be voted on. The purpose was to represent U.S. women not only to the rest of the world, but also to our own leaders in Washington and in state legislatures. At last, there would be democratic answers to the classic question, what do women want? I couldn't think of anyone but Bella who could dream up such a massive series of events, much less have the chutzpah to ask Congress to pay for them. Though I'd campaigned with her in a Manhattan that loved her, a Washington that feared her, and a women's movement that depended on her, I'd never seen her try anything this huge. Women in every state and territory would be invited to debate and decide such contentious issues as reproductive freedom and abortion, welfare rights, lesbian rights, domestic violence, and the exclusion of domestic workers from labor laws. Her request for $10 million was actually a bargain at 28 cents per adult American woman, but Congress went into shock. It delayed voting until a year after the first state conference was supposed to start. Then it slashed the appropriation in half to $5 million. Still, money was approved, and the National Women's Conference was scheduled for Houston in November 1977. To organize this mammoth undertaking, President Jimmy Carter appointed a new group of IWY commissioners. I was one, which is why I and about three dozen other members of this new commission ended up spending 2 years crisscrossing the country to help organize 56 conferences of 2 days each. I confess that I was as scared as I had ever been. This organizing challenge was a little like a presidential campaign with a fraction of the resources. It meant helping to create a representative planning body in each state and territory, including groups that probably had never been together before. I would learn the big difference between protesting other people's rules and making one's own, between asking and doing. Our election process for delegates was so open as to be terrifying. Anyone 16 years old or over could be elected if the result as a group represented the state racially and economically. Success can be as disastrous as failure, and it almost was. As if we had tapped some underground spring of desire, women came to conferences in such numbers that they overflowed the campuses and government buildings where our shoestring budget put them. In Vermont, more than 1,000 women slogged through ice and snow to create the biggest women's conference ever seen there. If most hadn't supplied their own brown bag lunches and childcare, our organizing goose would have been cooked at this first of all the state conferences. In Alaska, an auditorium designed for 600 had to make way for 7,000. Fortunately, most of the women good-naturedly sat on the floor. In Albany, the capital of New York State, more than 11,000 women, four times more than we planned for, lined up outside government buildings in the sweltering July heat, then waited most of the night in an airless basement to cast ballots for delegates and issues. I'd stopped in Albany for the opening ceremony, and then I was going home to write and make a living, but I ended up staying for 2 days and two nights without bed or toothbrush, helping with the voting lines. Events in some other states made us realize that we'd been living in a fool's paradise. To represent majority views was definitely not everybody's goal. For instance, only about 2% of the population of Washington State was Mormon, but nearly half the women attending that state's conference were. Such disproportion also turned up in Michigan and Missouri, part of a massive Mormon effort to head off the Equal Rights Amendment, then in its ratification process, and sure to be voted on in Houston. Though over 60% of Americans supported it, one Mormon woman was about to be excommunicated for campaigning for the ERA. Some said this opposition came from a fear that the ERA would take women out of a traditional role by offering them equality outside the home. Others pointed out that Mormon-owned insurance companies would lose money if gender-rated actuarial tables were outlawed, as race-rated ones had been. For instance, a woman who didn't smoke often paid higher premiums than a man who did smoke. Why? Because on the average, women live longer. Opposition literature also said the ERA could mean integrated restrooms, women in combat, husbands who no longer had to support wives, and more, none of which was accurate. On the theory that exposure cures many ills, Bella called a press conference to disclose this attempt to overrepresent one religious group. Congress members from states where Mormons had political power accused Bella of religious bias, demanding she apologize in public, and she had to. It was the only time I ever saw her give in to power. Some other religious groups were just as opposed to representative conferences. In Missouri, church buses brought 500 or so Christian fundamentalist women and men to the state conference, in time to vote, but not long enough to be tainted by open discussion. In many states, Catholic groups brought anti-abortion and anti-birth control pamphlets and picket signs, even though, or perhaps because, Catholic women were at least as likely as non-Catholics to use both. In Oklahoma, Christian fundamentalists voted to call homemaking the most vital and rewarding career for women, and then to end the meeting. I began to see that for some, religion was just a form of politics you couldn't criticize. In Mississippi, the Ku Klux Klan grew so alarmed at a multiracial conference that its members called in reinforcements and elected an almost totally white delegation in a state that was at least a third African American. Finally, we ruled what we should have in the first place. Registrants for the conferences had to sign up individually in advance, not at the door by the busload. Corinne Harbel, a founder of the Feminist Caucus of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, saw that anti-equality groups were distributing lists of issues to oppose in Houston, but pro-equality groups were giving out no lists of what to support. She put all the pro-equality issues into one national plan of action, made buttons that said, "I'm pro-plan," and spent weeks phoning delegates to explain why each issue was important. Once in Houston, her work in creating clarity would save the day. "I'm pro-plan" buttons would help women to recognize allies they didn't know, just as anti-equality delegates recognized each other by wearing red "Stop ERA" buttons. This long, hard, humorous, educational, angering, unifying, improvised, and exhausting 2-year process probably shortened all our lives. But it was worth it. On a hot November day in 1977, 2,000 elected delegates and about 18,000 observers began to fill the biggest arena in Houston. With issue areas from the arts to welfare and 3 days to vote on them, there was a feeling of urgency, excitement, and even a little fear that we couldn't pull it off. Also, hundreds of anti-ERA, anti-abortion, and other pickets were marching outside the arena in the hope of making sure that we couldn't. Across town, a right-wing and religious counterconference, led by Phyllis Schlafly, was getting equal media coverage for accusing the National Women's Conference of being anti-family, anti-God, and otherwise unrepresentative. Never mind that those counter-conference participants had been elected by no one. All I could hope was that Bella's tactics, for instance, including every Democratic symbol she could think of, would convey the difference. There were first ladies, Girl Scout color guards, and even relay runners, women athletes who set out from Seneca Falls, New York, where the fight for suffrage began, carrying a lighted torch all the way. Right-wing radio hosts attacked the first ladies for showing up at all, and Phyllis Schlafly's supporters in Alabama persuaded local athletes to refuse to run a crucial stretch of highway on the way to Houston. Despite dangers, a young Houston woman had flown to Alabama to fill in. As thousands of delegates plus alternatives began to arrive, several business conventions were late in checking out of Houston hotels. Our delegates were lined up for hours waiting to check in. I walked up and down the lobby lines trying to be reassuring. Observers from faraway countries were camped out next to women who'd never left their states before. Title IX athletes shared water bottles with women disability advocates in wheelchairs. Native Hawaiians compared long flights with Native Alaskans. And high-powered women leaders in the corporate or political world stood in line like everybody else. Despite a few meltdowns, most women seemed to be getting to know each other in a kind of celebratory chaos. If I hadn't been so anxious about the combination of counter-demonstrations and crucial goals, I would have felt celebratory too. As it was, I just longed to go home, put my head under a pillow, and forget this event that I cared about too much and feared would fail. In the midst of this chaos, about 20 women delegates from Indian country were taking matters into their own hands. They had found each other by putting a hand-lettered notice in the lobby. When no meeting room was available, they gathered for their own talking circle in a fancy anteroom of the ladies' lounge. Rarely had these women from different and distant parts of Indian country been able to meet together. When they told me this, I had my first flash of organizer's pride. If only this happens, it will be enough. In the cavernous Colosseum, young women officials in red t-shirts began admitting delegates to the floor. Groups slowly filled up its acres of chairs arranged by states, as in a presidential convention. Outside, picketers were still chanting angry slogans, but they were soon drowned out by the buzz from the floor and from bleachers filling up with observers. Up the center aisle, two young women runners brought the lighted torch from Seneca Falls, miraculously just in time for Maya Angelou to read the poem she had composed for the occasion. I watched from behind the big stage as two past first ladies and the wife of the current president, Lady Bird Johnson, Betty Ford, and Rosalynn Carter, greeted the delegates. The three women were applauded by activists who probably had demonstrated against all their husbands. Groups of observers holding signs from Mexico, India, and Japan cheered for a speech by Barbara Jordan, the African-American congresswoman from Texas, as, in her elegant rhetoric, she called for a domestic human rights program. Later, teenagers led a standing ovation for an anti-nuclear speech by anthropologist Margaret Mead, though I knew many had no idea who this feisty old lady was. With 26 multi-issue planks that had emerged from the states on subjects from childcare to foreign policy, there was both fervent debate and an undercurrent of worry about the time it would take to debate them all. As the hours went on, the chairs and parliamentarians rotated, each one looking like Toscanini conducting a huge and unruly orchestra. I listened to disputes over arcane points of order, and also to heartfelt speeches, demonstrations that interrupted everything, and much caucusing on the floor. I couldn't believe that, somehow, process and a sense of humor were prevailing. Despite fervent protests from all the women wearing anti-ERA buttons and American flags, the controversial sexual preference or sexual orientation plank passed. The conference had supported the right of lesbians to equal treatment in employment and child custody. Most surprising, Betty Friedan spoke from the floor in its support, marking the end of her decade-long stand that including lesbians, the lavender menace in her famous phrase, which was then adopted with humor and defiance by lesbians themselves, would damage or doom the women's movement. At last, a majority agreed that feminism meant all females as a caste, and that anti-lesbian bias could be used to stop any woman until it could stop no woman. Up to then, I had feared that our opposition was more unified than we were. For instance, the same groups that opposed contraception and abortion also opposed sexual relationships between two people of the same sex. It was irrational on the surface, but the religious right wing was against any sex that couldn't end in conception. Now, a representative majority was united, too, in recognizing that human sexual expression was not only a way to reproduce if we chose to, but also a way of pleasuring and bonding. By the end of the first day's marathon, Bella got laughter and cheers when she broke the tension by saying, "Good night, my loves." My surprise duty at the conference was a last-minute request from the various women of color caucuses to be a kind of scribe. I was to go from one hotel room to the next, one meeting to the next, writing down concerns that were shared by all, combining language for their approval, and appending issues that were unique to each. The goal was to compose a substitute for the so-called minority women's plank that had come up from individual state conferences, yet women of color hadn't been able to meet as a group. Asian Americans were spread from Hawaii to New York. The Hispanic caucus was mainly Chicanas on one coast and Puerto Ricans on the other. African Americans came from everywhere, and members of the American Indian and Alaskan Native Caucus were the most spread out of all. Houston was their first and only chance to meet and come up with a plank that included their shared and specific issues. Yet if they met during the day, they would miss crucial floor votes. As usual, double discrimination meant double the work. I was to be what they referred to cheerfully as our token, that is, the only one who wasn't a woman of color, going early in the morning or after hours at night from one drafting group to the next as they met in different hotel rooms. I would combine language where possible and list unique issues, then give the result back for the approval of all. This was an honor, but it also upped my already high anxiety level. I was afraid I would mess up. I wasn't even sure I could physically get to each meeting in the midst of conference chaos. As I went from one caucus to the next, I saw women camped out on every surface around breakfast or late-night snacks, from Houston's idea of bagels to Tex-Mex pizzas. Among the 300 African-American delegates were legislators skilled in parliamentary procedure and women who'd never been to a conference before. Deltas in silk dresses and students in army boots, radicals with no faith in voting and civil rights veterans like Dorothy Height, who had worked for voting rights since she was a young woman meeting Eleanor Roosevelt. While the African-American women raised umbrella issues of racism and poverty, the Asian and Pacific American caucus added language barriers, sweatshops, and the isolation of women who came to this country as servicemen's wives. The Hispanic caucus spoke about Chicanas being deported away from their American-born children, Puerto Ricans who were treated as if they were not American citizens, and Cubans cut off from families by tensions with their home country. Somehow, this all had to go into one substitute minority plank that could come to the floor and be voted on by all delegates. Still, nothing prepared me for the American Indian and Alaskan Native Caucus. These delegates from Indian country had the most educating to do. For instance, when Native women spoke passionately against termination, meaning of treaties, others in the minority caucus thought they meant termination as in pregnancies. While other women of color fought for equality inside the mainstream, Native women fought for that, plus tribal sovereignty and self-determination, outside the mainstream. By treaty, Native nations were supposed to have government-to-government status with Washington, yet in reality, they weren't even allowed to teach their own languages in schools. As one Native delegate said, "Other Americans have histories and families and gene pools in their home countries. If French or Arabic is forgotten in America, it's still being spoken somewhere. We have no other country. If our languages are wiped out, they can't come back. If we disappear here, that's it." From listening, I began to realize there were major cultures in my own country of which I knew nothing, and these cultures were struggling to keep or restore a balance between males and females, humans and nature, that modern social justice movements thought they had invented. Even the familiar term Indian country meant not just self-governing territories within the United States, but also a sense of community that exists within big cities and small towns, wherever First Peoples live. As a Cherokee activist said to me, "Indian country has become a shorthand for our home, reservation, or city. It is where we are known, where we are safe." I also noticed that humor was even more of a survival tactic here than in most women's groups. As one asked, "What did Columbus call primitive?" Answer, "Equal women." It was my first glimpse of how little I knew and how much I wanted to learn. Finally, urgent issues were reduced to phrases short enough for a plank to substitute for the original minority plank. Minutes before it was to be presented on the floor, a spokeswoman from each of the Women of Color caucuses gathered in an empty coat room to give the final okay to the text, then rushed out on the floor to surround a mic in the huge coliseum. First, Maxine Waters read the preamble on the discriminatory impact of sex and race combined. It was an honor that this young California assemblywoman had earned by her organizing skill in bringing all 300 diverse members of the Black Caucus together. Then Billy Knave Masters, a Cherokee educator and activist, spoke on behalf of the Native American and Alaskan Native Caucus, citing their unique issues of sovereignty and calling on Earth Mother and the Great Spirit. Those words didn't seem to belong in a political plan of action, but I had asked the other caucuses if I could leave them in. An older woman in the Black Caucus had agreed. "Those are the only words my grandmother would give a damn about," she said. "Issues are the head. Those words are the heart." When Billy read them, I saw delegates standing on their chairs to see who was speaking poetry. Next came Mariko See, a young Japanese-American actor who cited the struggles of Asian and Pacific Americans against language barriers, cultural bias, the realities of sweatshops, and the stereotypes of being a model minority, one supposedly without rebellion or problems. For the Hispanic Caucus, three delegates, Mexican-American leader Sandy Serrano Sewell, Ana Maria Pereira, a Cuban-American, and Celeste Benitez from the Puerto Rican Senate, came to the mic together. This was the first time that different Spanish-speaking groups had unified in public across national boundaries as Hispanics, something they were encouraging male counterparts to consider. They took turns reading and stood together on everything from immigrant rights and a minimum wage for migrant workers to reminding the media that Spanish-language reporters were not foreign press. Last came Coretta Scott King, standing with her bodyguard, a reminder of past tragedies and present danger. She cited the unemployment rate for young Black women that was even higher than that for young Black men, as well as housing bias against Black families, Black children in need of adoption, and more. Then she spoke for all the caucuses when she called for the enthusiastic adoption of this substitute resolution on behalf of all the minority women in this country. There were cheers, but her voice rode over them. "Let this message go forth from Houston and spread all over this land. There is a new force, a new understanding, a new sisterhood against all injustice that has been born here. We will not be divided and defeated again." With chants, applause, and tears, the 2,000 delegates accepted the new so-called minority plank by acclamation. It was the high point of the conference. I was as proud of my facilitating role as anything I had ever done in my life. In the back of this cavernous coliseum, someone began to sing, "We Shall Overcome." Like waves of an ocean, people stood to sing too. I saw a white man and woman from the Mississippi delegation, the group that had been elected as a state conference partly taken over by the Klan, reach across neighbors to hold hands and stand. By the second chorus, the observers in the bleachers and media were standing and singing too. Even after the singing was over, people raised clasped hands above their heads and chanted, "It's our movement now." No one seemed to want this moment to end. I was surprised to find myself in tears. Because these women had trusted me to help as a writer, I began to see a way of bringing together two things, writing and activism, that until then had torn me apart in everyday life. From those 2 years on, I divided my life into before and after. Before Houston, I had voted to pay some of our scarce funds to retired policemen who would know how to protect the conference from hostile demonstrators. After Houston, I realized that the young women volunteers with red t-shirts and movement experience had kept security far better than the retired cops. My lack of belief in them had been a lack of belief in myself. Before Houston, I had known that women in small groups could be courageous and loyal to each other and respect each other's differences. After Houston, I'd learned that women could do this in large numbers across chasms of difference and for serious purpose. Before Houston, I had said that women could run huge public events at least as well as men. After Houston, I believed it. At the end of an emotional closing ceremony that left all the delegates plus observers singing and chanting, clusters of women lingered for hours on the convention floor, talking, exchanging addresses, pledging to stay in touch. They seemed reluctant to leave this space that had been our only reality for 3 days and nights. Then at last I found myself standing alone, amid the litter and empty chairs, feeling my adrenaline draining away and exhaustion rushing in. I wondered, would anybody in the future know or care what had happened here? From my own college history courses, I knew that a century of abolitionists and suffragists had been reduced to a few textbook paragraphs. Magnetic people could be made to seem distant, boring, irrelevant. In newspaper coverage, the Houston Conference was far overshadowed by a brief and symbolic visit to Israel by President Sadat of Egypt. As if summoned by my doubt, three young native women were walking toward me across the Colosseum floor. One was carrying a red-fringed shawl with a ribbon-work border of purple and gold. Another held a long beaded necklace with a large blue and white medallion. They put the shawl around my shoulders, explaining that I could wear it while dancing at powwows. "And you will dance at powwows," said one with a smile. They put the flower medallion around my neck, explained it was beaded in the style of the woodlands people, and told me it would keep me safe. "You'll need it if you keep supporting us," said one with a hug. Then they left as mysteriously as they had come. I would indeed wear my shawl while dancing at powwows in the future. I wore the necklace whenever I had to do something I was afraid of, like appearing before an establishment group that made me feel as if I'd just emerged from East Toledo, a trailer park, or both. I wore it so often that I had to preserve the remaining beads in a bowl. After I came home from Houston, I slept for days. Then I began to read what other women were writing about it. One account was from Billy Knave Masters, who had read the Native American Resolution from the floor, the part with poetry. "If people do not take you seriously when it is a question of survival," she wrote, "Indians accept this as another loss in a history of many losses and just walk away." But those ways were set aside in Houston, the most intense and meaningful experience I will have in my lifetime. We came from such different lives, yet we felt the same way about Houston. For Billy, it was rare to find a public event with any inclusion of Indian country at all. For me, it was a glimpse of a way of life in which the circle, not a hierarchy, was the goal. Without this glimpse of what once was, and so could be again, I wouldn't have traveled in the same way, seen the same country, or become the same person. Chapter 3. Why I Don't Drive. Why am I writing an on-the-road book when I don't have a driver's license, much less own a car? I'm so used to traveling as I do that I didn't anticipate this question. I was once as obsessed as anybody else with driving as a symbol of independence. I signed up for a driver's ed course in my senior year of high school, though I had no car or access to one. I wasn't looking so much to be a driver as to symbolize the difference between my mother's life and mine. She was a passive passenger, so a driver's license would begin my escape. In the words of so many daughters who don't yet know that a female fate is not a personal fault, I told myself, I'm not going to be anything like my mother. When I was in college and read Virginia Woolf's revolutionary demand for a room of one's own, I silently added, and a car. But by the time I came home from India, communal travel had come to seem natural to me. I had learned that being isolated in a car was not always or even usually the most rewarding way to travel. I would miss talking to fellow travelers and looking out the window. How could I enjoy getting there when I couldn't pay attention? I stopped making excuses for being the rare American who didn't want to own a car. I even stopped citing environmental excuses or explaining that Jack Kerouac didn't drive either. As he said, he didn't know how to drive, just typewrite. I did sometimes quote public opinion polls that rated New Yorkers as the happiest of Americans. Why? Because in the non-driving capital of the nation, we actually see each other in the street instead of being isolated in speeding tin cans. But the truth is, I didn't decide on not driving. It decided on me. Now, when I'm asked with condescension why I don't drive, and I am still asked, I just say, because adventure starts the moment I leave my door. I am in a taxi on my way with a friend to JFK, an airport named after a president who was assassinated only 6 years before. Our older driver is like a rough trade character from a Tennessee Williams play, complete with an undershirt revealing tattoos and an old Marine Corps photo stuck in the frame of his hack license. Clearly, this is his taxi and his world. My friend and I are acting a lot like lovers, which we are. We are also hyper aware that the driver is looking at us in the rearview mirror. That's because while we waited with our luggage in a darkening street, a low-slung car full of white teenagers sped by, leaving behind in the evening air the lethal word, "Nigger." Now I can feel us struggling to forget that surreal attack and stay ourselves. When we reach the airport, the driver slides open the divider between the front and back seat. Both my friend and I grow tense. I always think that talking into that opening makes me feel as if I'm ordering French fries, but this time I am grateful for the barrier. We have no idea what the driver thinks of us. The driver thrusts something through the opening. It turns out to be an old battered photo of a young man in a suit standing with his arm around a plump and smiling young woman who is clutching her purse with both hands. "That's me and my wife when we got married," he says. "Except for when I was in Korea, we haven't spent a night apart for 40 years. She's my best friend, my sweetheart, but believe me, we weren't supposed to get married. Her family is Jewish from Poland, mine is Sicilian Catholic. They wouldn't even speak to each other until after their first grandchild was born. I'm telling you this because today is our wedding anniversary, and if you don't mind my saying so, you two kind of remind me of us. If you wouldn't be offended, I'd like to give you a free ride, so I can go home and tell my wife I helped another young couple like us." Surprised and touched, we say his words are enough, but we end up accepting because it matters so much to him. At the airport, we all stand outside his taxi shaking hands, a little awkward with emotion. "You know," the driver says, "me and my wife and you two, we're what this country is all about." Later, my friend and I will agree that the worst punishment of that racist shout in the street was making us mistrust this man when we first got into his taxi. Years pass. My friend and I are carried into different lives. He lives on the West Coast, has children, grandchildren, and a life I cannot know. We are only sure that we wish each other well. When I run into him again, almost 30 years later, the first thing he says to me is, "Do you remember that taxi driver?" And I do. When I enter a taxi, I find myself in someone's life. Kids' photos on the dashboard, religious or other decorations hanging from the rearview mirror, name and perhaps ethnicity evident from the hack license on display, plus the sensory hit of the driver's physical self in a small space, all plunge me into a mobile world. In what writer Pete Hamill calls a common strategy against loneliness, a fleeting intimacy with their passengers, drivers tell you stories and are happy to listen to yours. I discovered these worlds on wheels when I was first living in New York. After I began writing The City Politic, a weekly column for New York Magazine, I depended on cabbies not only to get me to my destination, but to give me tips on public opinion and elections. They tend to be shit-free guides to the state of social issues, and are often better political predictors than most media pundits. After all, they spend more time listening to random strangers than any public opinion poll could afford. They overhear more private conversations than a wiretapper, and they often are themselves new immigrants or work with those who are. This makes them treasure troves of information on what's really going on, not only here, but in other countries. An example came only 10 days after the 9/11 terrorist attacks felled the Twin Towers in Manhattan. I was haunted by the televised scenes of office workers diving to their deaths rather than be immolated in that inferno, images so terrible that television stations soon stopped showing them. Downtown streets were covered with surrealistic gray ash and debris, and gutters were filled with the bodies of birds that had been incinerated in flight.